I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 169 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. This week, we bring you part two of our Caro Pop conversation with guitarist, songwriter, singer Dave Alvin. In part one, he traced the evolution of his musical values, how the Blasters, the revved up roots rock band he formed with his older brother Phil, had lots of rules, while the Third Mind, his current psychedelic band, offers him far more freedom. This episode begins with Alvin discussing musical biopics and the one that put him off the genre for good. Hint, he was in it. Has Alvin seen A Complete Unknown? How did he wind up actually recording with Bob Dylan? What is Dylan like?
Abe said, "Well, you want this killing done?" And God said, "Out on Highway 61.
How did Alvin's chord names confound Dylan? Which Rodgers and Hammerstein classic did they record together? Will any of these recordings ever come out? There's a long, wonderful story here. Alvin also revisits his earliest songwriting efforts, including the first song he ever wrote and his initial contributions to the Blasters. One of those songs, Marie Marie, became an international hit for Welsh rocker Shaken Stevens. How did that success affect Alvin? Alvin went on to play in The Knitters and X, to have a robust solo career, and to collaborate with fellow singer-songwriters such as Jimmy Dale Gilmore. In 2020, Alvin underwent chemotherapy treatments for cancer, and he tells here how he had to overcome neuropathy to resume playing guitar. How much of his focus now is on being a musician as opposed to writing songs? What's next? Alvin is one of the wisest, sharpest storytellers out there, in song or otherwise. Please enjoy part two of this Caro Pop conversation with Dave Alvin.
If you never had trouble, you've never been alive.
So did you see A Complete Unknown?
No, I don't. I tend to not see. I don't watch music biopics anymore. I've seen some, and
which one was the final nail in the coffin of those things? You said anymore.
Well, I thought the Ray Charles one was okay. It was. It had some good stuff because it. But the problem for me with music biopics or any music movies, but I can't tell you which one I saw last that made me go, I can't do this. Yeah, I watched Ray.
If it was Bohemian Rhapsody, that would have been the last one. But anyway,
wasn't that? And it's nothing against any of the actors or whatever, but the experience of playing music. Making music and hearing music is so, I don't want to say diametrically opposed, but it's just different than the making of a film and how a film has to be presented. And so to me, it always makes people do puppy dog heads where I always say, to me, the greatest rock and roll movie was maybe, Treasure Sierra Madre by John Huston in 1949 with Humphrey Bogart, and Walter Huston, and Tim Holt.
It's a great one.
A movie that has nothing to do with music. But to me, the best music movie ever was the Rip Torn movie, Payday. And if you ever get a chance from the...
I've not seen Payday.
Oh, you got to see Payday.
All right.
Payday's the one of which to me all it's a Rip Torn plays this sort of country music singer who's kind of on his way down but had been big, and it's like two or three days in the life of this guy, and no movie has ever captured the absurdity and the cruelty and the beauty of the music industry as much as this one did.
Wow.
I know what movie was the Jerry Lee Lewis one with the
Great Balls of Fire.
And I'm in it. I picked up some good money. They did a they filmed it and they had an ending, and then they went out and did the thing where they tested with an audience, and the audience didn't like the ending, so they quickly gathered everyone back together, and I got a phone call. Because they couldn't get who was the guy. I think it was Jimmy Vaughn was playing the quote unquote guitar player in the band, and then Johnny Doe was the bass player, and John Ed Speakey played like Myra Gale's dad or something. And I think Steve McGallion played the drum or played the drummer. So Jimmy Vaughn was unavailable, so I got the call, and I needed dough, and I was like, okay, I'll do it. So then I could go on with some stories about this day of filming in front of extras, you know. And the Blasters had done a movie called Streets of Fire, where they were, Walter Hill, the director, was really right. trying to this what he envisioned rock and roll as. And the Jerry Lee Lewis thing was just so terrible. And the first mistake they made, in my view, was they started the movie when he was unknown and they ended it when he married his cousin. And to me, if you really wanted to make a great movie about Jerry Lee Lewis, you started it where he marries his cousin. And then take it from there. Because all the rest of the rags to riches thing is Dullesville, you know?
Right. Like, yeah. That's what everyone knows.
Yeah.
Go to the dark years. If Shakespeare was going to write the Jerry Lee Lewis bio, Shakespeare would have started it with the marriage of the cousin. And then all the dark bullshit craziness that ensued from there. But anyway, so that was it. I was just like, you know, Hollywood and the movies and music are just different. Movie people tend to look down on music people because, they tend to look down a little bit on all the arts because the way movie people view things is that they are all of the arts combined into one. They're visual, they're audio, it's writing, and if you're just playing music, well, you're just playing music. And we can use that. This sounds great, with our love scene here. We'll use this piece for our love scene, and then you can get out of here. We'll make the important stuff. And to me, when you're playing music, there's a thing that goes on. There's a thing that happens in your head that is, like I said, that Fellini captures it better than a guy sitting down saying, "I'm going to do a rock and roll movie." No. There's this abstract thing that goes on in your brain where you're thinking, you're living so much in the moment, that's just so hard to capture on, in a scripted piece, especially when they make it, like Rags to Riches and Boy Meets Girl. And that's a story about, the singer so-and-so and her relationship with her devoted husband. And I don't give a shit, So anyway, to answer your question, I'm friends with Elijah Wald, who wrote the book that the film was loosely based on. And Elijah really likes the film, even though he said it's fiction,
Right. I've seen that. And I picked up the book, actually. It's like next on my list.
Yeah, and Elijah is a brilliant, perceptive, maybe, in my opinion, maybe the best music writer, especially for roots music, And he wrote a brilliant book on Narco Corridos, which was this thing that was going on in the 90s with Mexican music. And so he learned Spanish and lived in Mexico and wrote this amazing book. And then he wrote a book about Robert Johnson called Out of the Delta. That's maybe the best book on blues that I've ever read.
I should check that out.
Yeah. No, anything by Elijah. I don't always agree with him, but he's brilliant, And so anyway, I'm to me, there's that film clip of Michael Bloomfield and Bob Dylan playing Maggie's Farm. It's available online. Watch that. That's it,
It'll be. I'll be curious, and I don't know if there's anywhere to measure it. How many people who are sort of turned on to this period of Bob Dylan who then go back to the stuff that actually is available? I mean, I saw the movie, and then I just went back and rewatched Don't Look Back, which I've always loved.
Yeah, that's a great rock and roll movie, and that's not really.
Dylan's a movie star in that movie. He's so prickly and charismatic, and you're just like, wow.
Well, that's the thing. That's the reason why he's Bob Dylan, he's everything, I mean, he has every personality you could want. You know, and I've worked with Bob a little, and you know, he's a generous, prickly guy, you know. But on the other hand, you know, with Bob Dylan, it's like, I'm amazed he can tie his shoes, you know, with everything that he's been through. Starting, you know, I saw this scene play out at this gig in 1989. That's a long story I won't bore you with, but I won't
be bored. Go for it.
Well,
it's up to you, but
it's a long story, but it involves the benefit for homelessness or something. It was the Roy Orbison Foundation or something was putting on, and I was there playing. I played guitar with a great singer named Sid Straw. I was her musical director at that time, and I played guitar with John Fogerty at that gig, and Bob sat in with the Byrds, a reunited Byrds, but before he went on with the Byrds, he and I had this long conversation because I recorded with him, you know, it's unreleased, but I recorded with him. So we're discussing stuff and making jokes. And he gave me the greatest line. He says, "When are you and your brother getting back together, Dave? That was you and Phil. That was magic, man." "I don't know, Bob. When are you going to go be in a band with your brother?" And then Bob goes, "Oh, man, my brother's a genius. He had a band, he wouldn't have me in it." And so anyway, so at the end of this event, I was out back, and it was the venue was just now demolished Universal Amphitheater out here. And so I'm standing there with my friend who was working for me, the late Wally Hanley. And so I got my amplifier and my guitar, and we're waiting. You had to be, because it was up on a hill, you had to be, they had to bring you your car, you know. So all these limousines are coming for the big stars, and I'm waiting for my 75 Chevy Impala to be delivered. And anyway, Bob had to walk out of the back of this building and get to where the limousines were. And it was maybe the distance of maybe a quarter of a football field distance. So far, but not terribly far, but far enough. And his son, he was there with his son, Jesse, and Jesse's wife, and whatever woman Bob was dating at the time. And they came out the back door and walked, you know, someone went and told them, "Your car's here," right? So then he comes out the back door and they're walking to the car, to the limousine. And the entire way that he has to walk, the entire distance, this is in front of him, about 300 cameras with flashbulbs going. And I'm standing on the side, and you know, whatever, half hour earlier, Bob and I were discussing, you know, steel guitar players and starting being in a band with his brother. And here he is now, he has to be this other guy.
Right. 1989, he's got 300 cameras in his face.
Yeah, it didn't matter that he hadn't made, you know, a good record in a while. He's still Bob Dylan. And, you know, you said he's the movie star in Don't Look Back, you know. He had that thing, and he still has it, you know, to this day. But I watched him do that, and I watched all these flashes going, and all the guy's trying to do is get to his goddamn car, right? And I realized, well, I don't want that for me. And two, if he can tie his shoes, because his life had been like that since Like a Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
And
it's like that in Don't Look Back. It's 1965.
Yeah. And it's 1989, and now it's 2025, and it's still the way his life is. And the fact that he can still write incredible songs and put on, you know, amazing shows when he wants to, just is an inspiration, you know. But yeah, when I saw that firsthand, I was like, you know, that's got to be really rough, you know.
What did you record with him?
One time he goes, "Yeah, you know that, sorry I didn't use any of that stuff we recorded, but it'll come out one of these days." It was like this little pause, and he goes, "You know, on one of them box sets."
Well, he's put out so many of these, you know, bootleg series, box sets.
Yeah, you know, it was record. I did this thing with them. It's a long story. It's one of the reasons I think we got along back then was he asked me to play on some stuff he was recording around 1985. And I had a gig in Sacramento. And the gig in Sacramento with, you know, I think it might have been with the Knitters, might have been with the Blasters, but I was going to make like $300, right? And I had a commitment to the gig in Sacramento. And so I told him, no, I can't do it. I got to be in Sacramento. And I don't think too many people have done that to him. And that kind of registered, you know. Because one of the things I think about anyone on that level of fame is they don't want to be treated at that level of fame. They want to be one-on-one like you and I are being right now. And so then a year later I was in X and I got this phone call, you know, hey, can you do a week in the studio? And we had a tour. We were like going off to play Atlanta and Houston and Dallas and stuff. And I was like, nope, I can do the first day, but I'm leaving town the next day. So I went and did 13 hours in the studio with him. It was stuff for...
Empire Burlesque would it be? Or Infidels?
No, God, I wish. So we cut a lot of stuff. You know,
Back That Loaded it was?
Well, those two albums.
Yeah, those two albums right around there.
We did these various sessions. Like my dear friend, my late dear friend Don Heffington's like playing drums on Brownsville Girl. You know, it was that era, and Don was playing drums on Lone Justice, because Bob was really, at that time, he was checking out the especially local LA bands because he lived in Malibu. So he loved the Blasters and he was into Lone Justice, you know, all that stuff. But yeah, we cut a lot of blues. We did, you know, Elmore James and Slim Harpo and Muddy Waters. And then we also did some rockabilly stuff, which was hilarious because, you know, Bob, if I knew you were going to cut this stuff, I would have called the Blasters, in, you know, because I had me and Al Cooper, who was my neighbor at the time, and I loved Al. And so it was me and Al. But then the drummer was Stevie Wonder's drummer, incredible drummer, but not the guy you'd call for a rockabilly gig. And the bass player was James Jamerson Jr., incredible bass player, you know. And I had met his dad. It's a long story, but anyway, so we all got along, but it's not the kind of thing, if you're trying to sound like the Blasters doing blues and rockabilly, well, I can make a phone call and get everybody.
You could put that band together pretty quickly.
And together for you, and you know, you want to do a Look on Yonder's Wall? We'll do it better than anybody else will. But then we also cut, we cut a couple of spirituals. You know, we did Samson and Delilah, you know, that thing. But then out of the blue, he says that he wants to do You'll Never Walk Alone, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein. When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. And the thing, we had been recording for like, I don't know, 8 hours, and suddenly he pulls out, he wants to do Broadway tunes, and Al Cooper does this, wah! You know? Bob is notorious about, you know, he wants to do one take, you know, first take, and I don't want to see any goddamn chord charts. And so Al went and distracted Bob, you know, and he tried to get him to change his mind. He said, well, what about doing, there's a Clyde McFadder song that's got the same chords roughly, and it's the same intent. You know, and Bob's like, yeah, I know that song, but I can't sing like Clyde McFadder. I want to blah, blah, blah. But, and then Bob, so Al gets him out of the room for like 5-10 minutes and then rushes back in, gets on his keyboards and starts chord charting out for everybody. Cause we're all like, how the hell do you play You'll Never Walk Alone? None of us have ever played it. So, and then I'm self-taught as a guitar player. And so I have different definition names for chords than your average guitar player would have. And so like a ninth chord, a particular ninth chord, I would call a T-Bone Walker chord, you know, and then a particular way of playing a suspended D or G or C chord, with a certain suspension, I would call it a radio chord, because in those days you'd hear that chord a lot on the Police or whatever. And so I had this chord chart that was Al showing me the chords on keyboard, and I'm just writing down, going, okay, Tilo Walker chord, radio chord, you know, Sunday morning chord, you know, this, that, and the other. And so then Bob comes into the studio, and there's, at this point, he had brought in a horn. He had Steve Douglas, the legendary sax player, and then some trumpet player guy. And Al had kind of arranged real quick. He arranged a Stax Volt version of You'll Never, like if Otis Redding had cut You'll Never Walk Alone. Nice. And then Bob came in though, and he sees the charts, and he sees the stands, and he's not happy with that. And he walks over to me, and he's like, "Dave, what are you doing with a chord chart?" And he looks at it, and he starts, "What's it? What's a T-Bone Walker chord?" I was like, "Oh, well, what's a radio chord?" "Oh, this." He goes, "Oh, wow, that makes sense." You know, and then we cut. Then he was happy. Then he was kind of like, "Okay." And then we cut it. And I got to say, you know, he had the horn section. He had the four female singers come in out of the blue. They just appeared out of nowhere, and you know. And we cut You'll Never Walk Alone. We did two takes of it. And the second take, I got moved by his performance. It was like, well, fuck, he was right. He could sing this song. And so we did a lot of weird stuff. But the only one I've ever heard is one of the Dylan bootleg people tracked down a version of Got Love If You Want It, the Slim Harpo song. And I know that that's me on guitar, because I know how I played back then. And, okay. Well, that,
You'll Never Walk Alone, you've never heard that version since then.
That I would love to hear. Because, again, I was, like, moved. Because Al did it, you know, Al did all of this arranging on the, you know, just like, bam! We had the horns, and when the horns, and then the four-woman choir, when you're hitting that, you know, walk on through the rain, walk on, but done Stax Volt, it was moving, you know.
We need to make this a mission. We're gonna track this down. I'm gonna do a little rock and roll detective work here, because I mean, they've only put out like 5,700 different Dylan. Yeah.
Nobody's really screaming for, hey, I want to hear outtakes from Down in the Groove. Right.
Where's the knocked out, loaded, Down in the Groove box? But yeah. they did do a self portrait box, so yeah. You're already.
That's true. But the thing about Bob Dylan is, you know, going back to Jimi Hendrix, you don't know what he's going to do. He's one of the few people in pop music still where you have no idea what Bob Dylan's going to do. You know, what's his next album going to be? I don't know. You know, is he going to do another Christmas record? Boy, that would be great.
That one threw me. I was just like, here comes Santa Claus, here comes... I was like, wait, really? It made me laugh.
Well, I mean, it's kind of
a holiday spirit.
Yeah, well, it's kind of partially his sense of humor and partially his hustle, you know, Bob. You know, there's a buck to be made doing Christmas records. You know?
Right, but like doing him as Bob, I mean, it seemed like something you would have seen on SCTV maybe, you know, some years earlier, but...
I kind of think Eddie Gorodetsky had a huge hand in that record. And Eddie was a comedy writer, and Eddie knows music. And he and Bob became close friends, and basically the radio show was Bob and Eddie. You know, the in time radio, Eddie wrote the scripts and everything. And you could hear when Bob was not reading on the script. But I think Eddie's sense of humor was kind of, hey, Bob, you know, it'd be a good idea. You should do a Christmas album. but you just never know what he's going to do. And that's kind of the glory of rock and roll. That's the glory of kind of musical freedom, you know, in the same way that maybe in society our freedoms are being curtailed, whether it's my addiction here or, you know, laws about you know, you can't park X amount of feet from a stoplight, you know, whatever laws, it's just freedom's curtailed, and in music, freedom is curtailed, you know, and it's been curtailed You know, I mean, I remember back in the '80s, with the early '80s, you know, where major labels wouldn't sign the punk rock bands that were selling out nightclubs because they didn't know how to market it, right? But they figured out how to market it by the time of Pearl Jam and Nirvana. But, you know, 10, 12 years earlier, they had no idea how to market this stuff to Pink Floyd fans.
Right.
And so, you know, and then sort of the corporate ownership of media limits everything down into, you know, you have to fit these molds. You know, you have to be a country singer, meaning Nashville pop music from Nashville. You know, it's not your great granddaddy's country music. It's bad classic rock, you know. And but you have to fit that mold, and you have to fit this mold over here if you're urban R&B, and you have to do this. You know, like when Beyonce did the Cowboy Curtis record, I just thought, thank you, you know. That's at least, you know, screwing with people's, you know, well, what's she gonna do next? Well, she's gonna do a not bad, you know, Nashville kind of record, you know.
Yeah, people still arguing whether it's a country record. I'm like, just be glad that, you know, she's expanding the boundaries of stuff that deserves to have its boundaries expanded.
I love the first song. I can't remember the name of it right now, but lyrically, I was like, yeah, those are really good lyrics. That's like, I won't say Guy Clark, but they were kind of Guy Clark-ish, you know.
American Requiem.
Yeah, if she was going to write a Guy Clark song.
Did you always, by the way, see yourself as a songwriter and a musician? Did you aspire to one and then the other?
Well, no, I always saw myself as a loser, you know, because I, you know, as a guitar player, I get my point across, you know, and I know the guys that I knew and seen that are on this other level. You know, Greg Lease is on this other level, and I'm good. You know, like I said, I get my point across. Am I Greg Lease? No, but I don't, you know, that's out of my league, you know, but I get my point across. But I think when I'm dead and gone 100 years from now, a couple of my songs will still be played. So I see myself as a songwriter, but growing up, I didn't see songwriting as that, you know. I mean, your career opportunity was a steel mill, you know, that was a job, you know. Songwriting's not a job. And so it's a weird knot I have in my brain about that, because I know a lot of singer songwriters and a lot of songwriters, and most of them, I mean, I wrote songs when I was a kid, you know, but I didn't walk around saying, I'm going to be a songwriter, where the songwriters I know, most of them did when they were 13, they wanted to be the next Bob Dylan. And when I was 13, I wanted to just talk to girls, you know, how do you do that? You know? So it was just not a reality for me.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
When I was a baby? Yeah. When I was a toddler? Yeah.
What was your first song you wrote?
I wrote a song that the biggest hit I had when I was like 3 or 4 years old was a song. It was based off of a Lieber and Stoller kind of coasters thing, you know, because that was what you were hearing on the radio, called I Don't Know and You Don't Care. I'm not going to sing it.
I was going to ask you if you still remember it.
Yeah, I remember it very well. You could tell by the lyrics that it's memorable. And then I wrote Marty Robbins' epic, you know, when I was a little kid, you know, what was it called? Sunset Hills, you know. And, but I, you know, again, it's not like I said, I have friends and acquaintances who, when they were teenagers, they were like, well, I'm going to move to New York City and be a folk, you know, folk singer. And I'm going to move to Nashville and this, blah, blah, blah. No, I was like, you know, I studied poetry. I studied creative writing in college. And I had great teachers, who didn't allow us really, you had to write in traditional forms. You had to write in, you know, you had to learn how to write a sonnet. You had to learn all the, you know, a lot of the various meters. And you had to learn how to rhyme not, as unpredictably as possible, and when to use a predictable rhyme, when to use a nasal rhyme, all those kind of things. But I always thought, well, I would become a English professor or something, and which would be pretty funny now. And but when the Blasters started, we just started to play, we were kind of, we wanted to take our blues and R&B and, folk influences, but we wanted to match it with sort of the intensity of the punk rock stuff, because we were going to the clubs up in Hollywood. We'd drive up to Hollywood to see the Weirdos or the Germs, at the Mask or something like that. And so I loved that, and I loved that fly-by, or not fly-by-night, the DIY, do-it-yourself kind of punk rock thing. And in those days, all the punk rock bands out here in L.A. sounded totally different from each other. The Weirdos didn't sound like X, and the Screamers didn't sound like the Dills. Everybody had their own sound and their own attitude and their own approach. And I found that liberating, You didn't have to fit into these molds, because, there was a lot of great musicians and songwriters out in California and L.A. in those days, but they all had to like fit into the mold of the singer-songwriter, the stereotype songwriter.
And was it clear from the beginning of the Blasters that you were going to be the main songwriter?
Yeah, because we didn't start the band to have original material. We just wanted to play, Howlin' Wolf songs and Little Junior Parker songs and, Carl Perkins numbers and things like that. And at one point we were told that we'd never get a record deal unless we had original tunes. And so my brother, who was the, band leader at that time, said, okay, everybody, next week come to rehearsal. Because our deal was we'd come in with old beat up scratchy 45s, Sun Records or Chess Records or King Records or whatever. And then we'd learn them, And so then we said, okay, next rehearsal, no old records. Everybody bring in, two, three songs. And I brought in three songs. Nobody else brought anything. And so, bing.
You're the songwriter.
That's when I became a singer, or not a singer, songwriter, but that's when I became a songwriter.
Was Marie one of the first ones?
Yeah. And that was the one that was kind of like, well, I'm not bad. I might be good at this.
Did you surprise yourself with that, especially when it became this like overseas hit?
Yeah. Like I said, I'd always written songs in my head, but I never really sat down and put them on guitar. And so now it was like, okay, you got these things in your skull. And I had certain concepts already that I'd been formulating, because studying poetry and all that, like I said, I learned sort of the structure of writing and meter and all that. And I knew, I won't say entirely how to tell a story, but I knew that there was storytelling involved and that I was drawn to songs that told a story, because inside of a story you could hide a lot of stuff, sort of like Sally Go Around the Roses on the Third Mind Records. The lyrics are real simple, but then it's so complicated, at the same time. And so I knew that there was that sort of magic to writing a song. And when I wrote Marie Marie, it was like, I wrote, the music came to me first, and I went and grabbed the guitar, and I was laying in my bed, and I was just strumming it repeatedly, this melody, and I had no idea what the song was about. And then the next day we had a rehearsal and this is true. It was like 30 minutes before we left, I sat down at the kitchen table with a blank piece of paper and I was like, I got to come up with lyrics for this. And then I remembered this scene that I had seen when I was a kid, up in the Whittier Hills and at the base of the Whittier Hills where there used to be these farmlands. And I saw this when I was like 8 years old. I saw this girl playing guitar on the porch of this old farmhouse. For some reason, that became it, And then 30 minutes later, went to rehearsal, and the band was like, wow, where did this come from? know,
you're hired.
And then, yeah, but then it, when it became an international hit, you know, it became
Shakin' Stevens.
Yeah, yeah. Who I had no idea who he was, and there was some people in the rockabilly world, and they were like, "Oh my God, Shakin' Stevens recorded your song," and I'm like, "Who the fuck is Shakin' Stevens?" And then it's like, you know, and but it's incredible. You know, his version is incredible. It's pasteurized to some extent, but it's done really smartly, and I believe it's Albert Lee doing the guitar on that. And it's a great pop record, pop rock and roll, rockabilly record.
And he's Welsh.
And he's Welsh. Yeah, I can't beat that. And then a great band called Matchbox, an English teddy boy band. They did a version of Marie Marie. They actually did it before Shakin' Stevens, but they completely rearranged it into something else, into more of a, like a mid-tempo country song. That's a great version. And then I started getting, you know, two things that I was a fry cook in Long Beach, California, you know, and I'd quit that once the Blasters were starting to work enough that, you know, I quit school, I quit my day job because I was going to make as much money being a Blaster as I was as a fry cook. So that tells you how much I was making, you know, but I figured, what the hell, if I can play rock and roll and not be a fry cook, I'm done. And then, yeah, about 6 months later when the Shakin' Stevens thing happened, then I started getting these royalty checks, you know, that were just like, oh my God, you know. And then, because with songwriting, these days they may have some schools, you know, now for songwriting. This is how you write a song. This is a verse, this is a bridge, this is a chorus. But really, most songwriters, there's no rules, right? You can write a song any way you want. Where if you're building a house, right, you have to have a foundation comes first, and then you build the walls, and then you put the roof on. Well, in songwriting, you could start with the roof, you know, and build down. And so there's no rules to it. And so you have to, for me, it was like I had to teach myself how I write songs. And every time I go through a songwriting jag, I kind of have to reteach myself how to write songs because, you know, I'm not the same guy. I am the same guy I was when I started writing songs, but I'm also not. And so you have to figure out, okay, well, this guy now, how does he write songs? You know, as opposed to the guy 20 years ago or 40 years ago.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Are you writing songs now, or are you sort of taking a break from it while you do the Third Mind stuff?
No, the thing about songwriting is I write songs all the time. You know, I have friends that, you know, I'm going to sit down and write a song every day, you know, variety. And I always kind of tease them, well, at the end of the month, you got 31 shitty songs, you know. And they're like, yeah, but you get one that's okay. And it's like, well, and I have rules. I don't do demos, you know, I don't write a bunch of songs and then go do demos. It's like, it's all up in here, you know. And if I come up with a song idea, it lives in my brain for a particular period of time. Then I'll sit down with the guitar and go, okay, what key is it in? You know, let's suss out the lyrics and all that. But yeah, so I'm always writing songs. You know, most of what I write in my head sucks, you know. And so when I have the real inspiration, I guess is a way of putting it, of, okay, point A to point C, how do we get there? Point A to point Z, you know, okay, I got it. Boom, sit down and write, you know. So, yeah, so I'm always writing, but to me, it's what's interesting to me now. You know, I've got a large catalog of songs that I've written over the years, and they kind of are like a panel of judges. And so you got these songs, and they're sitting like in a jury docket, you know?
Right.
Pull out, okay, well, I've got this new one. It's about a girl named Charlene, you know? And the songs, all the good songs that I've written go, no, it's not one of us. You can't be in the club, you know. So I go through that where there's a lot of, you know, even back in Blaster days, I mean, I was a heavy self-editor because I had to take the songs into these, you know, these guys that were older than me that were experienced musicians. And I'm coming, okay, it's a song that's called Marie, Marie, you know, and then you have to pass their approval, you know. So there's always those hoops you got to go through, you know, whether they're outside influences, you know. I mean, if you book a session and you go in with a bunch of musicians and you've got a new song, there's that still that fear of, okay, is this any good? And is that drummer that I really respect going to like this? Is that guitar player going to, you know? So, you know, writing songs is when they're ready, you know. And I'm more interested now, right now, my main focus, I wouldn't say is on guitar playing, but it kind of is. One of the drawbacks to my cancer treatments was I got neuropathy from the chemo. I had two different rounds of chemotherapy, and my hands were swollen like Mickey Mouse hands. They were gigantic.
Hmm.
You know, I have neuropathy in my hands. I have neuropathy in my feet, and the hands are sort of normal now, sort of. You know, the swelling's all gone and all that, but I had to kind of reteach myself how to play guitar, because there was like 7 months where I could not touch a guitar. If I touched a guitar, it was like touching razor blades because my hands were so sensitive. And so then when I came out of that, when the hands were able to touch a guitar again, I had to go back to, I couldn't play certain songs of mine. Like my theme song, you know, is this song, King of California, and I literally could not play it. And that was really depressing when, you know, it's like, here's a song you wrote, and it's a song you do it almost every gig, and you can't play it. And it's like, oh, God, you know. And so that was another thing, but was like, I will play that song again, and I will play it live, and I will, you know. And, you know, you go through all those kind of things where, you know, so anyway, so it became my focus right now is like, okay, you gotta be a guitar player again. And you're not going to let this disease take that away from you. You're not going to let the healthcare system take that away from you or the treatment take that away from you. You know, you're a loud barroom blues rock and roll guitar player. They can't take that away from me. I'm gonna practice scales. I'm gonna get, and now when I play, it means a lot more to me now than it did 40 years ago. I mean, 40 years ago it meant a lot because I'm learning, you know, okay, I'm a guitar player now. I can jump up and down, and now it's like, you know, this was taken away from me, and now I've got it back. What can I do with this?
You've played King of California on stage again since then?
No,
what was the first time when you did it again, and what did that feel like?
I felt great, you know. I did some gigs. One of my favorite guitar players is a guy named Rick Holmstrom, and Rick is the guitar player for Mavis Staples, and he leads the Mavis Staples band. And
seen him,
yeah. Which currently, right now, is the drummer Steve McGuyan and bass player Gregory Boaz were in my band. You know, Gregory was my bass player for 15 years, and And now he's playing at Mavis Staples. I mean, he's going up in the world, right? And but they were doing these gigs at the McCabe's Guitar Store out here, the legendary venue, and where Rick would, it would be Rick with Gregory and Steve, and then they'd invite, like, they'd have David Hidalgo, say, from Lobos, would come and play with them, or, you know, or somebody else, Steve Berlin, I think, did it, you know, and then they asked me, and I hadn't played in, like, 2 years. And I had gone through the whole thing of having to relearn how to play guitar. And that was the first gig I did back. And it was scary. And because of the neuropathy in my feet, you know, at that point in time, I couldn't feel from my ankles down. I had no sensation.
Wow.
You know, but every now and then you get this burning, terrible burning sensation and pain. But then most of the time, it's like you're walking on a cloud. So, you know, if you ever see, you know, certain cancer patients, we all kind of walk a little weird, you know. And so I did the gig seated and scared, you know, and had a great time. And it was just like, okay, I'm back. I can do this. Let's try standing up, you know, when we play. Let's see how that works. And so then I went out, yeah, with my band and Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and we did a run of shows up the West Coast, and that was great. Every night I was just, you know, rejuvenated, you know. And you know, my feeling is, like I said earlier, I love all types of music. I'm a blues guy. That's really what I am. But I love everything, you know. I love all the ways of playing the blues. I love all the ways of playing rock and roll. I love all that stuff. So that's what I want to keep doing. But I want to, you know, Michael Bloomfield, that second Butterfield record, you know, when Victor suggested cutting East West with the Third Mind, I was, no, you can't do East West. You know, that's the mothership. That's where everything that came after it came from. That, you know, the Dead, the Allman Brothers, Television, you know, with Tom Verlaine, all came out of East West. And Victor and I had both found this great record, that CD that Mark Knopfler, the keyboard player for the Butterfield Band, put out of these various versions of East West, live versions. And they covered back a 6 month period. And it's astonishing what Bloomfield was doing, because he was so, in that era, you know, pre-heroin, he was so fearless. And he didn't, Bloomfield, you know, a lot of blues guitar players and people that want to be blues guitar players are uptight about playing the wrong thing. You know, would B.B. King play this lick? You know, I don't think so. You know, Mike Bloomfield didn't have that hang up. You know, he went and made mistakes. And if he wanted to try something, he went and tried it. And so I figured, well, okay, in the spirit of Michael Bloomfield, all right, let's try East West. And so then we did it once in the studio. And then I was like, this is fucking fun. Why doesn't everybody play East West? One, you get older, and I mean, I never wanted to play what people told me to play. You know, if I had done that, my brother and I never would have started the Blasters, you know. I don't know how much time I've got. You know, I'm 2 years in remission from cancer, but it could come back at any time. You know, and it's like this sword of Damocles that's hanging above your head, you know, and they check me every 2-3 months. I have to have all these tests. And, you know, it could all end, you know, tomorrow. But a bus could hit me too. And I just, if I can do things like the Third Mind as well as my own stuff and you know, whatever comes down the pike that interests me, then that's, you know, I'm going to cram that into what time I have left. You know, it's the way I view it.
I had all these quotes from Steve Berlin from when I talked to him a while back about, you know, being in the Blasters and then sort of being in there and Los Lobos at the same time and the cultural differences.
I'll answer that with one quick story. Leave you with this. When I joined X, we were out on our first tour, and we're riding around in this bus, and I'm sitting next to DJ Bonebrick, and the drummer, and I leaned over to DJ, and this will tell you how Blasters damaged I was. You remember the Blasters were five guys that grew up together from childhood. Okay, so I leaned over to DJ and I said, "So DJ, when do we fight?" And DJ looks at me, he goes, "We don't." And I was like, "What? You're in a band and you don't fight? Really? We don't have to fight anymore? This is great," you know. And so that whatever Steve said is true.
He did say that at some point when he was like sort of in the studio with them and he was trying to make a point and he was yelling and they're like, "Why are you yelling? You don't have to yell." He's like, Oh.
And my brother and I, there was a particular song. The first time I put a minor chord in one of our songs, my brother and I wound up having, we came to fisticuffs.
He told me that there was like fist fights. And he also said, by the way, that the first time he ever played a baritone sax was on the first take, which was used of I'm Shaken.
Yeah.
He said
yeah.
he'd never picked up the instrument before that.
Yeah. Yeah. And he, well, Steve's one of those guys that can play anything, you know.
He also said here, and I'm losing my light here, but he said that you guys would have parties and there would be these crates of 45s and everyone would be trying to out obscure each other with the 45s you guys would be pulling out. Yeah. It sounded great. I would love to be at that party. So,
you know what? I'd love to be at that party right now too. You know, sadly, 2/3 of the people that were at them are dead, and the other third is on tour with Lobos or the Third Mind. So.
Do you still have the 45s though?
Oh yeah. Well, I lost a lot of stuff. I had a landslide.
Oh.
Mudslide about 15 years ago. I lost a lot of stuff. I still have all my Sun 45s and I've got some, you know, I don't have my brother had the 78s. And that was really where we were really good 78 collectors. And, and that's got a lot of my musical education collecting 78s when I was 13. You know. Now I'm lazy, you know. I mean, in those days, if you wanted to hear Wynonie Harris or Charlie Patton, you had to go find the old 78s. And now you just, you know, either you got 30 Charlie Patton songs on a CD or you can just click a button.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't grab you the same way as holding the 78 or finding the 78 in some dusty, you know, on some dusty, dangerous adventure to get, you know, found a Charlie Patton for 45 cents, man. You know, it's the way of the modern world.
Yeah, you could hear it. It probably sounds a little clearer this way. Thank you so much, sir. I really appreciate it. It's really a pleasure.
You got it, man.
That's all for episode 169 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Dave Alvin for telling such great stories about the Blasters, the Knitters, X, the Third Mind, Bob Dylan, and his own life. The albums The Third Mind, The Third Mind 2, and Live Mind are available from Yep Rock Records. Go to davealvin.net for more information about his solo and band work and upcoming tour dates. The Third Mind plays live March 19th and 21st in Morro Bay and San Juan Capistrano, California, respectively. Alvin also has concerts scheduled with Jimmy Dale Gilmore in Texas in May and early June. You can find Dave Alvin on Instagram and Facebook at Dave Alvin Original. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, the King of Illinois. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at CarolPopCast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.